Hello and welcome to the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we look inside the secret world of spying and intelligence agencies. And then on the Scholar Circle, how might the power of ideas shape countries and international power structures? The inner workings of intelligence gathering agencies has long been a sort of black box to the American public. How many are there? How do they cooperate and function? How have they changed? And what reforms are needed? Glenn Carl served 23 years in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, working four continents and in Washington, D.C. His last position was as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats on the National Intelligence Council, where he was responsible for strategic analysis of terrorism, international organized crime, and narcotics. His just-released book, The Interrogator, explores doubt that he faced with his most serious assignment, where he interrogated who was thought to be one of the most senior al-Qaeda detainees. You were with the agency 23 years. Maybe a good place to start would be how you experienced the agency change over those 23 years.
Oh, dramatically. Not too long after I retired in 2007, I was on a panel. And the first question, it was a woman, a junior officer, and she said, "Mr. Carl, what was the single biggest change you noticed in the CIA from the beginning to the end of your career?" No question in my mind, and that is the changed role of women. When I started in the mid-80s, early mid-80s, in the Directorate of Operations, there were a few, very few, senior females, and they had to be really, really tough because they would have been steamrolled. There were junior officer females, peers of mine at that time, just starting. And otherwise, to put it somewhat crudely, but not too inaccurately, women were viewed as a support staff or there for the pleasure of the men who did the real work.
What else did you see change? Did it grow? Did it shrink? Did the focus move?
Oh, many times the focus changed. I mean, of course, the agency will reflect broader changes in the society. So also, when I first started, if one were homosexual, one would be fired or prosecuted. And then midpoint in my career, so 15 years ago, I would guess, the laws changed and the regulations, I think because of President Clinton, and now to be gay is irrelevant and routine. So the agency's changed sociologically that way too. There are types of intelligence work that become the in thing and they rise and fall over time. So the paramilitary work of the CIA was very important when I first began in the mid-80s, and that's because of two things, largely. The efforts to defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan and the war with the Sandinistas and the Contras. And so those were in subjects, and there was a huge focus then on paramilitary Special Activities Division work. When the Cold War and those wars ended or petered out, then the paramilitary activities were no longer in vogue and the resources were redirected towards the traditional work of the agency again, which is human intelligence collection.
When you say human, you mean on particular individuals?
Convincing individuals to spy for the United States. So I would approach an individual and say, "Have I got a deal for you?" That's the heart and soul of the CIA's job. Special activities, paramilitary work, those are sexy things.
In the paramilitary work, you mean recruiting the paramilitaries to work on behalf of?
No, not necessarily. People who are highly trained, very impressive professionals in military skills. So if we are supporting the Mujahideen in their war against Afghanistan, the fact that I studied Thucydides in French is not directly relevant to the task. But if you're a special operations veteran, your skills are directly relevant to helping our allies in their effort against the Soviets. So that's paramilitary work. There are other things, too. When the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended, then the central mission, historically, of the CIA ended, which was the Soviets. And we had to redirect again. And for a time, there was a debate, a search for, well, what is our raison d'etre? What's the mission now? And so is it economic intelligence? Is it political intelligence? What? George Tenet in the mid-90s, I think, saved the Directorate of Operations by reinvigorating and focusing resources once again on human intelligence collection. 6 years later, in 2001, of course, 9/11 occurred, and once again, paramilitary work as relevant to counterterrorism operations became the prime focus of where people wanted to go because you always want to be the pointy end of the spear.
How did changes in the administration affect the CIA?
It's tremendously influential.
Give us some examples. You were there 23 sure. years. That's a long time.
Well, yes, unfortunately. Or fortunately. When I started my career, Bill Casey was the director, and he was a veteran of the OSS in World War II. So for him, bureaucracy and the rules were hindrances and irritations, and he found the agency culture to get in his way.
Because the agency
followed the rules and had procedures. And part of the rules are to obey the laws. And he was mission-oriented, one could say. And he wanted to get the Sandinistas. And don't be a hidebound bureaucrat for me when I'm telling you that that's the mission. Arguably, that attitude led to Iran-Contra. When the directors changed, so did the culture. John Deutsch was focused on technical intelligence. He thought that satellites were important. And, of course, everyone, these are all shades of degree. But he also thought that human intelligence was slow, outdated, and done very poorly by the CIA. So he was open in his denigration of the Directorate of Operations and Human Intelligence Collection, which was the historic core of CIA's mission and heart of its culture. So he was not highly regarded by many of his subordinates. And then it changed again. So the director is critical, very influential in our attitudes, as is presidential administration.
Because the presidential administration would appoint the director.
In part because of that, but also because of the administration's focus and the issues to which it will have to respond. So George Bush II was obviously seized with 9/11 and counterterrorism, and that became the central activity of the Central Intelligence Agency and the administration for the 8 years of the Bush administration. The administration would argue that that was a response to necessity. One could argue otherwise, that it was a choice. But whatever the answer to that issue, the fact is that the agency follows the guidance and does the bidding of the executive, and the executive wanted counterterrorism as a priority, and so that's what it was.
In terms of the other intelligence agencies, is there a relationship, and how does it work, if so?
To answer that would be the work of multiple books. The relations are intimate, ongoing, 25 hours a day, all the time, among all the now 17 agencies of the intelligence community.
17,
right.
Can you name some of them?
Oh, sure. Well, there's the CIA, everyone knows about. There's the National Security Agency, which does electronic intelligence, picking up radio conversations and so on. There's the National Geospatial Agency that does satellite observation. There is the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the Department of State that does analysis. There's the Defense Intelligence Agency that is a military copy of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was explicitly created by Robert McNamara so that the Secretary of Defense would not have to be beholden to an agency not under his control. And that has continued. One could argue that there is a lot of redundancy, but the counterargument is that different opinions working on the same issue provide perspectives that are complementary. Then there's Marine Corps Intelligence Agency and the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and so on. The core intelligence agencies are CIA, DIA, NSA, INR, Defense Intelligence Agency, State Department Intelligence and Research. So they're huge, and they work together in an infinite number of ways all the time. They do operations together overseas. They do analysis together or as constructive rivals on any issue.
Then say the CIA was working on an issue, say, in Afghanistan. You also have Army intelligence there. Do you have FBI there also?
The FBI is overseas in many countries, so it's quite possible they would be there, yes. Let me give a concrete example. Let's say the president wants to know what's happening in Waziristan, the ungoverned border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The question would go to the National Intelligence Council, where I was the deputy national intelligence officer for terrorism, essentially. And I would call together to chair a meeting of the intelligence community. Each of the 17 agencies would send a representative, and I would say, the president has asked us to assess what's going on in Waziristan. And I would then dole out or coordinate how the responses would be prepared. I'd say, I need your respective assessments in 3 days. And they would send them to me, and then we would hash out. I would put it together in some sort of a coherent structure, and then we would hash it out. And I would say, okay, NSA says there's nothing happening, and CIA says that they have 400 nuclear weapons there. What's the truth? How do we answer? What do we do? And you hash it out. So you work together analytically all the time. Also, my experiences are typical. That's why the examples are useful. I was an operations officer for most of my career, meaning that I conducted operations to penetrate terrorist organizations overseas. And I worked intimately with the FBI on any number of cases. And I worked with the military on cases. And they brought their operational perspectives and expertise, as I did as a CIA officer, together to say, well, you know, I can pick the lock here, or I know how to speak that language, and we'll do this thing together.
You mentioned earlier about the Iran-Contra scandal, and there were quite a few convictions in that. And you've also described in your book this sort of gray, having to choose between unethical and unethical, essentially, or borderline ethical. And I wonder, when you look at Iran-Contra, can you put that into a context of the kind of gray area that you found yourself working in?
Oh, I can directly and firsthand, because it is a precursor experientially for me and should have been for the agency and our government of what I lived in the global war on terror. The gray area, well, I'll give an example. One of my superiors when I was working on Iran, I never worked in Iran, on Contra Sandinista issues, was sent to Central America. And the Boland Amendment had made it illegal for the United States, therefore the CIA, to provide lethal aid to the Contras. Well, that's the law. His job was to work with the Contras in circumstances in which the men with whom he worked were going off into combat routinely. And he was forbidden to arm them, but his orders were to have them conduct these missions. So that was a dilemma for him, because he didn't really want to send people unarmed, most likely to their deaths. And he had to decide what to do. And what he chose to do, unbeknownst to anyone else, was he provided them lethal aid. And that came out, and he was charged. And as I recall in testimony, the senator asked him, sir, are you aware of the Boland Amendment that outlawed that? And he said, yes, sir, I am. Did you provide lethal aid, sir? And he said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, how can you explain having knowingly broken the law, given your oath? And he said, sir, I don't know what things are like where you come from, but where I come from, you don't send people off to their deaths without giving them at least a chance to defend themselves. And I think one can only sympathize with the dilemma that he confronted, and he chose a path that was illegal. But he was in a terrible dilemma, and arguably you could say it was a clear issue that he can't break the law, but I think it was a gray moral crisis where no choice was the right one for him.
How often is that before you or your colleagues?
Something as stark as that, a life and death situation of war and clear legal obligations that one breaks, is rare. And that's an extreme example. I knew that man well. He's a fine man. More typical is a morally gray issue where your job is to get someone to commit treason. And to do that, you have to play upon that individual's deepest hopes and win his deepest trust. Or hers, and then use that trust to serve the ends of the United States, which are not necessarily good for the individual, but that is the job. So there is a constant tension between the need to manipulate to accomplish your mission and your effort, which will be sincere also, to be of good faith to the man whose trust you are winning.
You said that you had to break laws, steal, lie about almost everything, and exploit people. To do your job.
That's the job. I was going to say a paradox, but it is an exceptional challenge, morally, intellectually, and psychologically, to win someone's trust sincerely. And to do the job right, you really have to. People see through falsity more often than one would imagine. So you do want to be a good friend to this person, the angel of his hopes. And
that had to create cognitive dissonance.
For many, I think it does, and many officers, well, few people suited psychologically to do the job, and the agency does a good job of sifting, and then people early in their career will sift themselves, because it is a strange series of paradoxes that one lives all the time. Those who can work out how to compartment your simultaneously shared but contradictory emotions and moral obligations become good officers, and those who don't will leave. But dissonance, I don't know if I felt cognitive dissonance. I became good and at ease psychologically with my job, but it took a while to learn, because also paradoxically, but sensibly, the agency seeks to hire people of high moral rectitude who are deeply principled. And that is a contradiction with the obligation to manipulate others' deepest principles in a Machiavellian way. But that's the job.
So how many officers are there at a time in the CIA operating like this?
Well, that I can't say. That's a classified number. But I think I can say the general public will imagine that the CIA is everywhere. And certainly foreigners imagine that every time a traffic light goes out in La Paz, Bolivia, that it's the dark hand of the CIA is behind it. And we would always joke and think, well, if only, if only. In fact, the CIA is shockingly small, or the Directorate of Operations, shockingly small. People, I don't think, would believe how few of us there are. And it's typically our errors are those events that are discussed. But I think the agency and its personnel do, on the whole, remarkable work, given the resources that are spread really pretty thin.
There's a section in your book where you're describing what you went through, particularly with regards to this person who was the suspected high-level al-Qaeda person. And you said some call it torture, but you didn't yourself call it torture in the book.
Did I not? Maybe I didn't
use those words. You consider it torture?
The simple answer is yes. Certainly the Bush administration and the agency worked hard to muddy the waters on that. And it is true that no one in the agency acted without direct authorization. I'm confident of that. And the authorization came from the president. And we were told that the president had consulted with the Department of Justice to verify that all actions that were ordered and authorized were illegal. And the agency was explicit, people above me, the senior levels of the agency, that it received clear legal guidance and authorization before doing anything. All of that is true. It's also true, however, that the guidance received was a hackwork bit of political flimflammery written by a political appointee that had nothing to do with 800 years of Western history and 250 years of American history, that didn't even make a mockery. It simply destroyed a habeas corpus, trial by jury, rules of evidence, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the Convention Against Torture, the Geneva Conventions, the Executive Order 12333, which guides CIA officers' operations, and was clearly in contradiction with them all. So was it legal or illegal? One can argue, if one is a casuist, that it is both. You know, morally, the spirit of our laws and the clear laws and regulations we had, the actions that we engaged in are at the very least unacceptable.
It seems to me that you wrote this book partly because of that experience seeming wrong to you and the administration's particular directive.
Oh, you don't need any qualifiers whatsoever. I wrote the book because I was terribly distressed, shocked, but sincerely shocked. I'm not the Casablanca pretense here, and deeply, deeply concerned as an American citizen that I was one of the few people who has firsthand knowledge and experience in what we did to ourselves and how gravely and egregiously we undermined and contravened the principles, regulations, practices, spirit, and letter of our laws and our society. And if I didn't write about this, I would then be a tacit cover-upper, and I wouldn't do it. That this, to me, what we did and what we have done to ourselves is as grave a crisis with as deep an impact on American laws, institutions, and society as anything that the United States has done since the internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans because their eyes slant only, that's the only reason, or since My Lai, or since McCarthyism.
Do you think most of your colleagues are on the same page as you?
I think most of my colleagues were profoundly disturbed about the impossible choices and dilemmas in which the CIA and its officers were placed. And there is always a bell curve of response to any specific action or circumstance. But generally, overall, the bell curve, all but maybe one or two standard deviations on the extreme, shared deep concern about what we were doing and what we did to ourselves. And our job is to do the hard tasks that are unclear as to whether they work or are right, but are ordered and we are assured are legal and in the national interest.
So in the 23 years you were with the agency, was this the first time that you felt this level of disturbance?
Oh, certainly. As I said, I worked on the Contra Sandinista war. I worked on the kidnapping of American officials, the CIA chief, and American civilians in Lebanon. I did counterterrorism work. I recruited people to commit treason. That was my day-to-day job for 23 years. There was nothing not remotely, as disturbing or that has raised as grave issues about American society and our government as the enhanced interrogation program and the misperceptions and delusions of the war on terror. Nothing remotely like it.
And where does the line get crossed? How does it get from this is okay to this is awful?
The agency and its officers take our oaths really very, very seriously, to the point of sacrificing or devoting our lives to it. And the oath is to preserve and protect the Constitution of the United States, uphold its laws, and serve the national interest. And the national interest can be ruthless, but it can never be to traduce the values and the laws that we are sworn to protect and the interests we are sworn to advance. And so when you have clear laws, the Convention Against Torture, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you have all the checks and balances of our General Counsel's office in every sub-bureau of the agency and the government and the Department of Justice and the General Counsel's office and the Director of the CIA's office and in the White House, and you have oversight committees and on, and you have all of these measures to guide and make sure that our practices and actions are acceptable and serve the national interest, and all of them fail because of the work of or the actions of about a half dozen people, so that our laws no longer protect us and our regulations and oversight practices no longer protect us, and our officers take actions that undermine the Constitution and habeas corpus and don't protect us. This is terrifying, because our government is then no longer a government of laws. And to say it sounds crazy, that doesn't happen in America, but it did. I lived it. And that is very frightening. And then even worse is that not only did it happen, but it happened with the broad, although innocent and ignorant, support of the American people, who had been told, we are protecting you, we are doing things that are necessary, it's okay. And the people said, well, okay, that's right. And that's right then accepted practices that undermined our laws. And that is really shocking.
You retired before President Obama took office, but I imagine you still have a sense of if things have changed back.
Well, I know that they changed quite a bit back. John Brennan is President Obama's National Security Advisor for Terrorism on the National Security Council. And I know John well, and I think very highly of him. He has a quite sophisticated view of the nature of the terrorist threat and a sophisticated and deep understanding of and commitment to our laws in spirit and practice and letter. And I know for a fact the paradigm that shapes our sense of the nature of the terrorist threat and the actions that we can take to counter it is radically different now than it was under the previous administration.
Two last questions. One is, now with your background and understanding through all these administrations and all of the questioning that you've done internally, what is your sense of Guantanamo Bay and what should be done about that?
Guantanamo is a blight on our society. Candidate Obama was right to say that that was the case and that he would close it. It is more than lamentable that because of political pressure and some practical considerations, to be fair, but for political pressure, he's been unable to close it.
Political pressure being what?
Well, the Republicans have come up with any number of arguments saying that we can't bring detainees onto American soil. It's too dangerous. I just find that would be laughable were it not so outrageous.
What about the agency itself? What is it saying?
Well, most parts of the national security establishment, most agencies, have wished to and sought to close Guantanamo, I would say, for years and years and years. The practical problems to which I alluded, however, are There are some detainees who will be tortured if they are returned to their countries of origin. By law and morally, we cannot do that. And the Bush administration struggled with this problem too, and so it wouldn't send them back. Cannot. The administrations have been unable to bring these people to American soil for trial. So what do you do with them if Republicans make it impossible to bring them to the soil for detention or trial? We can't try some of them because the evidence that would be used was obtained either by measures that are arguably illegal or obtained through intelligence sources and methods, which, if revealed, would endanger the lives of our sources and our practices. So we're stuck, and no one has been able to figure out what to do. But it is a blight, because habeas corpus, I would argue, if one had to choose one practice in Western civilization that is the triumph and foundation of our freedoms, it is habeas corpus. And it is not just made a mockery, it does not exist.
Last thing I want to close with your experience, especially your last few years, if you were going to propose reforms to particularly the CIA, but also into the intelligence world, maybe they're political because of what you were facing from the top levels, what would you propose?
Well, this is one of the distressing points and conclusions that I come to, and I'm afraid I dismay, if not dishearten, people that ask me this issue when it comes up, because the terrifying, frankly terrifying, reality discovery that I made, among many, as I was involved in the war on terror and specifically interrogating this individual about whom I write, is that the laws are in place. We have many laws against torture and how to follow certain procedures to obey the laws as officials in the executive branch. Oversight does exist. Legal staffs know their obligations. Officers take an oath and know our obligations. We don't need more laws. We don't need more regulation. None of it sufficed to stop a half dozen or 10 dedicated, purposeful men from overthrowing all the efforts of thousands of good people over hundreds of years. It didn't suffice. It was very easy. So laws don't answer the problem. And I think the only thing one can do is to bear witness and shed light. And light and knowledge of practices make it harder to do wrong. I think that's the only thing that we didn't do that we could do, because all the other measures had been put in place and were there to protect us, and they failed.
You were clearly disturbed about this. Did you and your colleagues discuss it amongst yourselves? And did you have a sense that others were equally disturbed?
Oh, I knew that many were disturbed. But I will say, during the time I was involved in the interrogation of this individual and was running it or part of it, the work pace is so intense that one doesn't have sessions in which one mulls over issues like this. And also, you receive your orders, and you have to try to do them as best as you can. And you don't argue with your subordinates, gee, you know, I think there's a morally ambiguous position here. And you don't say to your superiors that, really, although you are encouraged and expected to bring your judgment to issues at all times, nonetheless, you have to get on with the job. So there wasn't a lot of hand-wringing discussion during that phase. At headquarters, for years, however, many of us openly discussed the contradictions of our orders from our obligations and what to do about it. And it was, frankly, a frightening time, because to challenge authority led to professional and personal destruction. That's Orwellian.
Our guest is Glenn Carl, and the book he has written is The Interrogator, An Education. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
When we come back, the power of ideas to shape countries, foreign policies, and the world. Stay tuned.
There's no way out of here when you come in, you're in for good. There was no promise made, the part you played, the chance you took. There are no boundaries set, the time and yet you wasted still.
Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. How do ideas shape political realities? How do they interact with other, more concrete factors to drive political agendas and then shape countries and international relations? How might the reinterpretation or misinterpretation of these ideas and concepts change the course of history? We're joined by three experts. Elizabeth Borgwart is a professor at Washington University and the University of Chicago. She is author of A New Deal for the World, America's Vision for Human Rights, and the forthcoming The Nuremberg Idea, Crimes Against Humanity in History, Law, and Politics. Tim Lynch is professor in the School of Social Sciences and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He is author of a number of publications, including Turf War, the Clinton Administration and Northern Ireland, and the forthcoming Cambridge Essential History of Post-Cold War U.S. Foreign Policy. Christopher McKnight Nichols is a fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and professor of history at Oregon State University. He is author of Promise in Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. The main purpose of this is to look at this evolution of U.S. foreign policy and how we got to where we are today. And each of you have looked at this different eras and also from different approaches. And I thought one of the places to start would be with Liz Borgwart. You led one of your articles with how ideas themselves affect the future.
And it's not so much ideas on their own, but ideas as energizing institutions, as energizing individuals or social movements, the way ideas connect and interact with other factors. I think the classic image is the sociologist Max Weber saying that ideas are never going to be the coal that fires the engine of that train of history, but they can be the tracks that the train goes on. And obviously, where the tracks are really affects what the destination is, that you where you wind up.
I'm going to ask you to give some examples in a minute, but I think maybe where we should start in looking at that is Chris McKnight Nichols. You have looked at these concepts, ideas, and their interpretations of, say, isolationism, internationalism, and how much people's ideas about the ideas have affected what the United States has become as a world player and how that has, of course, affected the rest of the world, starting with maybe even the founders.
I agree with Liz Borgwart that ideas really matter, and ideas may matter in some ways more in foreign policy. So I would start with sort of two maybe fundamental precepts of that, that on the one hand, ideas matter to the masses. This is true from 1776 as it is to now. That is, sort of mass ideologies legitimize the roles that policymakers can take on. And then ideas clearly matter to the policymakers themselves. They frame the tracks. They frame the system of how individuals and groups, the train of state, to continue that metaphor, where it can go. So just to lay out a few of the more specific yet abstract ideas that have informed sort of revolutionary policymakers and others, there's always been a kind of ideological fervor and what you might call a messianic streak in American foreign policy. And you might also note then, too, that there's been something that we are really recently, historians and individuals throughout the world are greatly interested in, and that is kind of thinking about what Jefferson called in the Declaration of Independence, decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Now, certainly American foreign policy hasn't always, or perhaps even often, cared that much about the respect for the opinions of mankind, but that has also been a major part of American foreign policy making. And I would add as well, pragmatism, or sort of a more diminished form of pragmatism, that is a willingness to compromise and achieve vital goals, has been something that unites Washington, Adams, Jefferson, to far later followers in their footsteps, like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, and others.
It seems like in your book that it's also the reinterpretation of those original concepts that have shaped eras and directions. Like, what do they really mean? So the meanings about the concepts.
Absolutely. There may be sort of nothing more American than a sort of a sensibility of the nation's own exceptionality, which is often referenced through the early American Republic, the early history of the Republic. In terms of foreign policy, my work, I single out three what I call policy pillars. Those are Washington's farewell address in 1796, Jefferson's first inaugural address in 1801, and the Monroe Doctrine of 1823. And these are referenced for virtually every policymaker thereafter, regardless of the direction they want to take the country. They try to update the model of steering clear of foreign entanglements, to paraphrase, for each era.
It seems like we've gone quite a ways in the other direction from that. Tim Lynch, let's bring you in.
Well, I'd agree with much of that. I think it's worth restating that the United States is an idea. There is no United States until they have a revolution predicated on this idea. We know that other nations have had revolutions and have been animated by some very profound ideologies and very problematic ones, but the nation predates them. So if you looked at the English Revolution, the French, the Russian, the Chinese, these revolutions don't create the nation. America is created by its idea, by its ideology, and as a consequence, it's more prone, in this sense I think it is exceptional, it's more prone to ideological behavior and ideational discourse than most other nations, even though these other nations have had very well-defined periods of ideological behavior. You think of the Nazis, you think of fascism, communism, whereas the United States has this ideology, but in some strange way it's become powerful as a state because of its pragmatism as well as its ideology. It's understanding how these two things relate to each other and balance each other, complement each other, that is necessary for explaining the overall success of American foreign policy over the long term.
And you say success of American foreign policy, which I'm assuming you mean by the U.S. becoming such a large global player in the world.
I think it's a very simple metric, and even those that have a downer on current expression of American power. It's gone from being a diddly squat trading outpost on the eastern seaboard of British North America to being not just an important global power, but the most powerful nation in world history. Now, I know geography has something to do with that, and climate and the absence of neighbors, etc., etc. But it also has something to do with its foreign policy and how it's dealt with the world. All the other competitor states, Russia, China, Britain, France, Spain, they all had notions, universalist notions of their model, and they've become not irrelevant to world history, but they played a secondary role. And we can debate how far this is going to endure. But the American system prospered. It went from nothing to really being everything, whilst the competitors failed. And I think that's got something to do with its foreign policy.
Tim makes a fascinating series of points about American exceptionalism, which has been very much in the news of late. And, you know, it reminds me of the opposition between traditional ideas about American exceptionalism, that it had a lot to do with having a frontier, for instance, the famous Frederick Jackson Turner thesis from the previous century, and the idea that because of the frontier, Americans could sort of remake themselves at any given moment. And then you have more modern ideas about American exceptionalism, like the, I know I'm quoting so many sociologists today, but Seymour Martin Lipset saying, you know, there's a basket of values that can be considered quintessentially American, notably individualism, and that if you subscribe to these values, that makes you American, because it's an ideationally oriented idea, American exceptionalism. It's not just that there are frontiers other places too, right? Brazil had a frontier. Russia had a frontier. So maybe these ideas about being separated by oceans and having frontiers are necessary but not sufficient. Maybe even similarly with having a revolution, but some of the ideas that Tim is talking about synthesize to make. What's the difference that makes a difference, I think, is an exciting question.
That would bring in the question of these ideologies and how they have shaped the direction of leadership. For example, Liz, you talked about FDR advancing the human rights movement without really meaning to.
Right. It's much in the way that Professor Chris Nichols just articulated. In my book, I also use as a jumping off point a particular document. It was called the Atlantic Charter of 1941. It's not nearly as well known as the documents that Chris just referenced, but basically it was a statement of war and peace aims. And what's cool about that is that it was negotiated in August of 1941, which is, of course, before the United States is in the war, right? So it's before Pearl Harbor. So what is FDR doing, negotiating with Churchill a set of aims for the post-war, you know, what the world is going to look like after this war is over, that the United States isn't even in yet. And human rights were central to that vision in a way that went beyond just sort of generalizing the rights that we find, for instance, in the U.S. Bill of Rights.
Chris McKnight Nichols, let's bring you back in. And in addition to this trajectory, I'm also curious about the sort of ebb and flow that you noted in your book, particularly with the anti-imperialists and the isolationists who were pacifists, and how they have shaped or not shaped really where we are today.
So one thing that I often point out when I talk about my work on the subject is that humanitarianism is a relatively newcomer to the ideology, foreign policy kind of nexus. And it's the first moments of thinking about humanitarian intervention in the American context come with America's rise to world power in the late 19th century. And in particular, the sort of prism there is about the Spanish-American War and Spanish atrocities against Cubans. But of course, there's a notable blind spot as well that we see emerging right at that very first sort of genesis moment, and that is a blind spot towards American, not particularly humane activities, say in the Philippines and other words. For instance, the advent of waterboarding in American military affairs is actually in the context of the counterinsurgency against Filipino revolutionaries. But in terms of the ebb and flow here, you have from the late 19th century through the present, I hate to call it poles, but you see sort of hybrids of different visions. So on the one hand, you have those who oppose interventions abroad, generally speaking, and others who embrace them on a wide array of terms. So what I try to do in my book is to show the genesis of modern ideas about isolationism and show their actual relationship to new visions of internationalism. So, for example, in the 1920s and 1930s, you have fascinating alliances between so-called isolationists, like the Republican senator from Idaho, William Borah, a staunch isolationist, a so-called irreconcilable, with pacifist internationalists like the settlement house worker and reformer Jane Addams and Emily Balch, the first two women, actually, first two American women to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And they worked together for the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928 to outlaw war, for example. So what this shows us, I think, is that isolationism and internationalism were less of a binary and could often be combined in how Americans, policymakers and activists thought about their nation's role in the world.
Tim Lynch.
I'd agree with that. In some ways, these stereotypically oppositional concepts of isolationism and interventionism are both products of exceptionalism. You seek American isolationism because America is special and different and shouldn't be sullied by contact with the outside world. And but using the same rationale, you demand intervention to make the world in America's image. There's a common core. I mean, I think in some ways, and perhaps I don't want to overplay this, but there's a far greater complementarity in some of these quite differing understandings of what the nature of American power is, which has actually been very helpful in crafting what I've described as an effective foreign policy over the long term. Other nations tend to get sucked into very contrasting positions. I don't want to overuse the German analogy, but clearly in its history, it's had periods where it's looked outwards and periods where it's looked inwards, and these have had a markedly different impact on the quantum of German power. Whereas in the American case, America has got stronger in some ways because of the interplay of these two forces that seemingly pull it in the opposite direction. I'm partial to Walter Russell Mead's model. He outlines these four different foreign policy traditions, but his point is not that they are separate and distinct and cause dissensus and schizophrenia, but they work together over the long term. And that's why you're obliged to account for more success in the American story than you are its absence.
Given where we are today and given this ideology and the idea and hope that the U.S. is actually a moral place, and the contradictions with things like what Chris mentioned in terms of the torture and the waterboarding and the massive amounts of deaths that have come as a result of some of the foreign policies. How do we reconcile the ideas and the rhetoric with the reality? Liz Borgwardt, I'm going to throw this to you.
Rhetoric can very often bootstrap reality. It's not a static snapshot of the relationship of rhetoric and reality. When I talk about that very aspirational document I just mentioned, the Atlantic Charter of 1941, you know, I'm sometimes asked when I speak about it, well, was it rhetoric or was it reality? And I feel like, well, what should I say? That it was, you know, 75% rhetoric and 25% reality. And like, that's the answer. No, I mean, when ideas are put out there, they inspire people, they change behavior, people get together, they form groups, they pressure decision makers. And it sort of circles back to, there's a sort of human impulse to reduce cognitive dissonance, I think, by sometimes slightly bringing the rhetoric and the reality into closer alignment. And one quick example that I would give would be, because we're historians, right, I'm going to give a historical example, but from the mid-70s, when the United States was negotiating with the then-Soviet Union in Helsinki, Finland, and you had this Helsinki Accord that was supposedly toothless and had all these human rights provisions. That's why the Soviets agreed to it, because there were no enforcement provisions. But it sparked, in many ways, a human rights revolution, because people started to believe that, you know, these Helsinki watch groups sprung up all over the world, all over Eastern Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, people started writing, you know, poems about human rights and having human rights plays in their basement. And the rhetoric, in effect, changed the reality because it reshaped people's perceptions and expectations and even their culture.
Did we also see that here within the U.S., Chris McKnight-Nichols?
Absolutely. I'm struck both by the fact that rhetoric does play out in altering the terms of politics, domestic as well as foreign policy. So one connection here that we haven't yet made is between domestic and foreign policy. That is, used to be said that partisan politics stopped at water's edge. This was a classic phrase that policymakers noted. And yet, in fact, as we all know as citizens and as human beings, we tend to frame political rhetoric and political decision-making in terms of both domestic and foreign. That is, one of the ways in which we think many individuals debated the Iraq war and the yearly costs of the Iraq war was to think in terms of limited resources and the fact that roughly the yearly burn rate for the first four years or so was something in the order of $30 to $35 billion a year. That happens to be about the same amount as universal health care. Now, we know this is a false quid pro quo, but thinking about the rhetoric of foreign policy, of these commitments abroad, often has a domestic reference. So, for example, thinking back in the past, the racial reformer W.E.B. Du Bois argued that, quote, civilization begins at home, that the kind of rhetoric of civilizing other peoples and other nations, the sort of manifest destiny justifications that American policymakers were putting forward, in fact, had a clear corollary at home, and that is you can't go abroad to enact civilization and fulfill American democratic ideals until you fulfill them at home.
It's interesting you'd say that. I've heard many political scientists on our campus actually make that remark about exporting democracy. Well, why don't we fix ours first? And that sounds like the place to bring in Tim Lynch.
I think it's a good question. But if you make your foreign interventionism contingent on your domestic perfection, then you won't do anything. America would be a big insular power. We know it acts highly imperfectly. But on balance, over the long term, what we've tended to prosper by, and by prosper I mean the delivery of freedom to people around the world, has been the product in the last 100 years of the application of American hard military power. Europe wouldn't exist in the form it does. Japan wouldn't exist in the form it does had America not waged war on them and in them. So I think in some ways this notion that you can replace this basic currency, hard American military power, with something nicer, a softer version, is problematic and not borne out by the historical record. So I think it's all very well to build a vocabulary of human rights and to trace this lineage, which I think is long and a very worthwhile thing to do. But we forget that the notion of human rights is contingent on their enforcement through power, through hard military power. And in the 20th century, that job has fallen to the United States.
I think many people would argue that there may have been excessive force in most of these cases in which there was so much loss of human life and other very important aspects of humanity that it's hard to justify the other side.
I think it's an argument worth having.
So, Elizabeth Borgwardt, let's bring you back in on this.
Again, historians never like to talk very much about the future, but I think that this idea of, I mean, I'm so happy that Professor Lynch was talking about power, because I think a lot of particularly human rights specialists sort of shy away from these kinds of terms, and even in international relations, it's how do you talk about the interaction of, say, power and culture. I was talking about the Helsinki effect, so-called, earlier from that 1975 moment of having an ideology, you know, inspire a social movement that then led to changed expectations and reconfigured politics. But we could even look now at, for instance, the Arab Spring. You know, who knows what the future of Arab Spring is? But it strikes me as patronizing to say, well, you know, human rights are a Western construct. You know, they're not for you because they're not indigenous. So, you know, why don't you come up with some other way of framing your aspirations? Young people in the different Arab Spring movements have taken these ideas that maybe were publicly articulated in a more Western idiom initially, but they've really made them their own.
In terms of the concepts we're talking about, bring in the concept that Joseph Nye uses, soft power, persuasive power, power of ideas. How does that fit in with American history, Chris McKnight Nichols?
It strikes me that both Tim's and Liz's points here intersect with another interesting aspect of American ideology in terms of foreign policy, and that is the ways, the sort of unintended consequences that American policymakers' rhetoric can entail. So a great example, Liz's work, for example, on the Atlantic Charter, and what she calls sort of a New Deal for the World, emerging even before America begins to fight the Second World War, or thinking about some of the paradoxical ways that isolationism emerges as something that cuts short annexations abroad, or American interventionism in my work. Or another example that comes to mind is Erez Manella's book, The Wilsonian Moment, which details how in Egypt, India, China, Korea, and beyond, sort of Woodrow Wilson's ideas about the 14 points, his call for a free, open-minded, absolutely impartial adjustment of colonial claims, often configured as self-determination, really resonated with nationalists around the world in ways that Wilson himself didn't foresee and didn't particularly like. So some of the ways in which American foreign policy ideology plays out can be problematic, but actually can also be deeply empowering on a world stage.
Sometimes leaders say things and mean something completely different. And I think, Liz Borgwardt, that was one of the things that you wrote about, that it is interpreted in one way, whereas the leader means something completely different. Perhaps look at what the underlying intentions sometimes are. It sometimes is this rhetoric of human rights really an excuse for building power or building economic superiority or something to that effect? What do you think?
Well, I'm often asked variations of the question, you know, aren't human rights just a mask for imperialism? And, you know, I mean, it reminds me, it's a sort of international version of when I'm asked about, I often teach about the New Deal. And so the question will be, you know, wasn't the New Deal just a mask for stabilizing capitalism? And with both of those questions, for me, the key word is the word just, because it was that, but it was some other things too, and so too with human rights, where there are moments of great fluidity in international politics where you can have things can be tugged in a somewhat more progressive direction. And you mentioned leaders meaning something different. I mean, that classic example in my book is the arch-imperialist Churchill, you know, articulating some of the most highfalutin phrases in the Atlantic Charter about all the men in all the lands living out their lives in freedom from fear and want. That's actually, he was paying a compliment to FDR by sort of quoting Roosevelt back to himself. But he was then asked in the British House of Commons if that applied to British colonial possessions in India and Africa. And he stood up and said, you know, I didn't become the king's first minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. I meant it for an inspirational value to help bring the United States in to support us.
Tim Lynch?
Well, I think this is a very interesting discussion. My concern in the discussion we're having is that if we disconnect concepts like human rights and exceptionalism from the capacity to enforce them and realize them, I think we have a problem. One of the great ironies in American history is that as America has got more powerful, and this bucks the trend, a thickening of international law. International law is the tool of the powerless. It's what you insist on when you haven't got the capacity to realize your ends through other means. Whereas the United States, and this is part of its exceptional character, has been at the forefront of international human rights regimes, of international law, as a way of building in its rule of law concept at home at a global level. I think that still requires understanding and recognition.
Chris McKnight-Nichols?
It strikes me that ideological positions have remained relatively fluid in American foreign policy, but there are some strong examples of those from Jefferson and Madison responding to British trade restrictions in the early 19th century, or Wilson in the League of Nations. When American policymakers have refused to compromise, they've met defeat. But you've also had examples, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger's kind of realism, sometimes described as amoral realism, also couldn't really survive indefinitely without firmer foundations in maybe the nation's more, what we might call, more well-revered past principles. So it seems to me that we're struck with a kind of deep paradox about ideology in American foreign policy, that perhaps the most widespread belief, something that we've all been talking about today, is that American foreign affairs is a peculiar aspect of American history and that it has a sort of exceptionalist model. This is something that foreign policymakers have almost always wanted to attend to. And yet, the American public, at least historically, hasn't made many demands on policymakers to get deeper inside their ideologies, to understand more fully what ideologies guide our foreign policies. And so I wonder, as an open question in the 21st century, whether or not the American people, in terms of democratic accountability, will ask more about the ideologies of their presidents in terms of foreign policy.
That's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you to the three of you, Elizabeth Borgwart, professor of history at Washington University and University of Chicago, and author of A New Deal for the World, America's Vision for Human Rights, and the forthcoming The Nuremberg Idea, Crimes Against Humanity in History, Law, and Politics. Tim Lynch, professor in the School of Social Sciences and Political Sciences at University of Melbourne, author of publications including Turf War, the Clinton Administration in Northern Ireland, and also the forthcoming Cambridge Essential History of Post-Cold War U.S. Foreign Policy, and Christopher McKnight-Nichols, who's been with us once before, who is at the University of Pennsylvania and a professor of history at Oregon State University, author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of the Golden Age. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Great.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at armudian. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.